I'm going to be a little awkward doing this, but...
Try not to use the scroll bar to use the arrows, focus on the page, and then use arrows instead. It usually helps.
I have no idea what he just said. All right. The thing is that in 1997, I answered an ad in the Sacramento Bee. They were looking for a Java programmer that could write expert systems. And so I said, well, I can program Java. I've been doing it for 2 weeks. And I went down and I built expert systems in Forth, a really funky language that comes from the satellites and the astronomy people. My first inference engine was written in Forth on an Apple II computer in 1983. And so I took this job, and the idea was this was, remember, the year 2000 scare. So this little company called The Money Store was trying to go from a two-tiered system to a three-tier system, and they wanted somebody to put rules in the middle tier, and this was the big thing, business rules. So I wrote them an inference engine in Java. And they rewarded me by firing me because they didn't need me anymore. And so I went to work for a medical informatics company up in Petaluma and did the same thing. We were making a three-tiered hospital system with business rules. And then I ended up at VerticalNet. Actually, I went to work for a little company called Asadra, which got bought out by VerticalNet while I was being hired. And so I ended up working for VerticalNet. And what we built was this huge vertical ontology. It was an upper ontology, and Leo Oberst was the leader on that project. And then we had hung these vertical things. We had nursing, we had waste disposal, we had all these vertical industries hanging under it. And we built this huge Java-based ontology server that would map catalogs of parts, electronic resistors and so forth, so that people, agents, could come in and say, I need a 0.05 Framis, and the ontology would look it up and find the catalogs that answered. So that's what we did. And then I ended up at SRI working again for Adam Trier, and it's just been a joy because they actually pay me to do what I want, which is play with ontologies and software. Bill Gerald showed you the picture of Kalo, and I was on the team that built the Iris desktop platform, and we've open sourced it. It's now on the web, and you can download it at openiris.org. And recently, we discovered something that I coined the term just for me. When you have a bunch of ontologists who live down in Texas who write these ontologies for offices, and then you have a bunch of Sarah and Sam secretaries trying to use the damn thing, and they have no idea what it means to disclose something or whatever, you have a mismatch, a big mismatch between the ontologies and the users. And so we started talking about this problem of making Iris, the desktop workstation, just for me. The idea is the ontologists can have their way in the background, but the users have a whole different universe of discourse, and we need to put the two together. So I wrote a paper for a conference titled Just For Me, and the idea was if we wrap the ontology with a topic map, we can allow the users outside to play in their namespace. They can name things whatever they want. They can create their own little relationships. And then all we need to do internally is figure out how to map what they did to the ontology. This gives you the sort of separation. Well, that's the groundwork for what I'm talking about now, because it dawned on me that there's a bigger picture that I'm talking about, and it's cultural federation. It's the cultures that are involved. And in fact, think of this planet as nothing but a whole bunch of tribes all running around, and they each talk their own languages and they bump into each other. And by the way, an awful lot of really cool stuff comes out when tribes bump into each other, but sometimes wars do. And so there needs to be a way to federate tribes so that they can have their own languages and not lose the essence of what it is that they are, but still maintain some sort of semantic interoperability with the others. And what you'll see in my talk is that if you do it carefully, you end up forming what we call wormholes. I didn't coin that term. You know, the word wormhole goes all the way back to Star Trek and before that. But Patrick DeRusso is the guy that was reading what I was writing about, and he says, oh, you're making wormholes. So I'm going to ascribe the term wormhole to Patrick, but he's the guy that in the ontologue talk said that I invented the term. I didn't. Okay, so I've set the record straight and given credit where I think it's due. The point is that if you go into a set of ontologies that have been federated, and that's what I'm going to explain, what happens is, if you federate those ontologies the way I'm going to explain it, and there are some use cases where you'd never want to do it this way, but there are use cases where you do. And under those conditions, what happens is, while you are looking at your favorite ontologist statements about some object, a cat or whatever, you look up and you see a little light bulb on in the same subject area, and you decide to follow that path. You just took a wormhole. You went out into somebody else's universe of discourse. And out there, you're going to get these aha reactions. You're going to say, oh, my God, I didn't know that. And then you're going to come back a better person for it. That's the idea. And it turns out, and I hope to show you this if I can pull it off, Delicious, DEL.ICIO.US. How many people know about Delicious? Now, how many people have actually used it? Until you use it, you don't get this. But once you use it, you say, oh, my God, where was this, you know? It turns out, I'll tell you my first experience with it. It was just another one of those Web 2.0 things, and I think that's all, you know, smoke. And guy at work came into my office, and he says, you've got to go try it. And the reason he said that is because we were going to build a clone of Delicious. Well, how can I build a clone if I haven't tried it myself? So I did, and I went and I tagged my own website, openiris.org, and I tagged it with Semantic Desktop. And it came right back and said, 13 other people have used that thing. So I went and looked at what those 13 other people had done, and I thought, oh, my God, this thing is awesome. Look at all these things they've seen that I've never heard of. That's a wormhole, and those are the chance discoveries that I would like to promote. And that's what federation is about in the context of what I'm talking about. Just to keep the record straight, there are contexts where you don't want wormholes. Example given, somebody asked you to make an expert system to aim a cannon. You don't want that cannon saying, hey, guess what I just found. You don't. You want it to aim the cannon. Okay. So there are times when you don't federate according to the rules of the road that I'm going to lay out. There are times when you literally do have experts, domain experts, who you pay and you can fire, say, this is right and this is wrong. That's a whole different story. That's ontology merging, ontology integration with a completely different set of reasons for doing it. So if you can keep those two separate, then you won't be offended by what I say, okay? Because I found that people who didn't get what I was saying get really offended when I say what I'm going to say. So let's... Okay, number two, I'm not using PowerPoint. I won't say I've sworn off PowerPoint, but I've seen another light. And unfortunately, I don't get to show you the other light because the screen wouldn't let me show it. It wouldn't take my computer, but... I'm using an open source and free product called Compendium, and it's at the compendiuminstitute.org, and it's sort of being intellectually shepherded by some wonderful people at the Knowledge Media Institute at Open University in Milton Keynes. Really great people, really good projects, and they've got a hold of Compendium, and the process is called dialogue mapping. Now, I'm a mapper. Now, how can I talk to you from something that's so damn linear when I'm talking non-linearly? Okay? So let's use a view that's non-linear. And all I can do is show you the HTML export, which Compendium doesn't do that well, which is, I didn't want to show it to you, but you're going to see it anyhow. So I'm going to talk to you about federating ontologies. And what I have to do, I hope you're right, Peter. I'm going to double-click on this ontology A, and, hello. See, Compendium would show this a little nicer than this. This is a little excise from Psych, and it's for the class called Atom. And so we tried to show you what Atom is about. So I have to read. It's a specialization of a chemical object, and it's an instance of something or other. And it has, this is the number of, in the nucleus, and it's one. And I made that red, and there's a reason for it, and I'll come back to it in a moment.
Close to the window.
What?
Close to the window.
Yeah, pretty good.
I'll forgive you.
What do you mean close the window? Don't just hit the back button?
It opened up a new window for some reason, so click on it.
Isn't that
no, not this.
Where? Oh, this? Listen, I have familial essential tremor, and I can't do this. Why doesn't it click? Oh, there it is. Okay. So now I get to go over here to... does anybody know what familial essential tremor is? Everybody thinks it's Parkinson's. It's not. Okay. It's where you get the shakes. Okay, so this is Sumo's atom. And it has one or more electrons and one or more protons. And again, something about the nucleus in one. And I colored that red. Now, there's a reason I colored it red. And I will come back to it. Trust me. But I'm just setting up the use case in which I'm going to federate the two ontologies that had those classes in them. And what I'm going to show you in a moment what I mean by federate and all the rest of it.
I can do this from here.
Please. Wonderful. Oh, God, look at that. It's magic. Okay, so let's just go down and open up federate defined. Yeah, it's down underneath. Down. That's it. Okay, I'm going to draw a very tight circle around my use of the word federate. And everybody always asks me this, so I'm just jumping the gun so that you don't have to ask me. Federate in the dictionary is to unite in an alliance. We can agree with that. All right. But I'm going to add another axiom to it, and that is that you shall leave intact all of the messages that you federate. You don't get to throw anything out. There is no censorship due to authoritarian decisions being made. And this is why I was giggling this morning when we got off on these toots about what you were doing. It's you don't get to erase anything, okay? If somebody said it, it goes, and there's a reason for it going, okay? That's federation. And so you can close that. And now let's just go straight in. Okay, there are other solutions. Now, I don't have to go into there. I will just tell you what it says. What it talks about is the fact that the database people have been doing this for bazillions of years. Okay, they've found ways of matching records, finding records, the distance between records. There's all kinds of ways, and all of them are heuristic. And all I'm going to do today is introduce a new heuristic to the game. The AI people and the ontology people have all kinds of heuristics, some of which, according to use cases I mentioned earlier, are throw it out if you don't like it. Okay, that's the authoritarian thing. We are ejecting that. Mercilessly, we are throwing out anything to do with authority. But we're going to give you another heuristic that will serve. Now, I'm going to say up front, it's a difficult heuristic. We don't really know how to do it well yet. We're just stumbling in the dark. But we think we have some ideas, and we hope that others will join in and come up with even better ideas. So let's look into the subject mapping map. This is where we nest into another map. Federation with subject maps. What is the key? The key is what I call subject-centric federation. You heard me inject the word subject in the talk this morning. The mantra would be, it's the subject, stupid, and that's the nature of this beast. In other words, if I can show that your ontology class is talking about the same subject as another ontology class, they have to merge. Now, that's going to start lots of arguments, and that's good. Because the arguments will bring out the tails, the implicit stuff that people didn't bother to put in their ontologies. They had their own reasons for calling it that or whatever. You had a question.
The question is there a difference between subject maps and topic maps?
Thank you. That's an outstanding question. I'm sorry I didn't say it earlier. Because I just made the seamless transition from topic maps to subject maps. Okay. Topic maps in ISO 13250 are associated with two things at the moment, the SGML, which is called HiTM, and the XML, which is called XTM. And both of those are associated with some really rigid ontological commitments. In XTM, you are allowed to only talk about topics and occurrences and associations. And within those, they tell you which properties you can use. So if you want to do something like identify, do a property to identify a subject, okay, like a birth date or a ethnicity or whatever it takes to identify, absolutely unambiguously identify this person, like him or you or anybody else in this room, you're going to have to come up with some subject identity properties. Well, XTM didn't give you a graceful way to do that. So there is a third branch of topic maps now called the reference model, TMRM. And in order to keep the marketing departments of all of the XTM companies happy, we stopped calling them topic maps. We call them subject maps. And that way they can keep doing their topic maps, which, by the way, are extraordinarily powerful and very useful for what they're doing. But when I will claim that when you move into bioinformatics and any of the other informatics, let's just leave it at that, XTM is not going to be graceful enough. You can do it, but you're going to work really hard. What the topic map reference model said is, we are making no ontological commitments. You make them yourself, but you must declare them so that others can follow them. And if you have rules for merging, if you have a subject identity property and you use it in a merging process, you must disclose the rules which allow the merge so that others can come and make their, render their stuff mergeable with yours if they choose. That's the nature of the beast, okay? So that's subject maps. It's mostly marketing. They're underneath the skin, they're the same philosophical stance. It's the subject, stupid. Very explicit. And we don't call them topics anymore. We call them subject proxies because that's, in fact, what they do. They are containers that stand and represent some subject. And you'll see some slides that try to show this, okay?
Well,
everything's an ontology in disguise. You can see. Okay, so I did answer your question. Okay, so let me answer a couple of questions like what is federation? I already told you the definition of it, but now, Peter, if you would bring up the slide that says federation with subject maps. That one, yes. Okay, federation uses the topic maps reference model. It's an abstract model with no syntax or data model. It leaves it entirely up to the needs of the users. And what we hope is that a little industry will come around and do the ontological engineering necessary to come up with subject maps that everybody can use. They will make commitments. We don't have a problem with that. But in the federation scheme that I'm talking about, let's hope they make commitments that allow people to federate without arguments. Okay? The same subject can have multiple ways of being identified. Okay, for example, in other words, you know, a rose by any other name is still a rose. This is the issue that we take with people who think that just names for things is a way of identifying things in the ontology. I'm working with the NeuroNames Project, which is Douglas Bowden at University of Washington, and he points out that the hypothalamus has a bunch of different names for it. And they all come from different authorities. These are people that in the early 1900s discovered it and gave it some names. Somebody else rediscovered it, gave it new names, and the trick is to merge them. You can't remerge them around their names. You have to merge them around some other subject identifiers. And in neuroinformatics, they know that there's a particular kind of stain, which if you use it on a slab of meat from a brain, there will be a behavior that you can say that is the hypothalamus. And so that's one of the candidate subject identifiers. Geographical location in the brain doesn't work because the hypothalamus in a rat is different in a different place than it is in a human and so on and so forth. So you have to pick your identifying properties. That's the nature of the beast. We can leave this. Hello. So What is a subject map? It's a collection of subject proxies. It can't get any easier than that. It's just a set. One subject gets one subject proxy. Not two, not three, not four. The guarantee of a subject map or any topic map is that you only have to go one place to learn everything that's knowable to that map about a particular subject. Now, you and I know that when you do a federation project where you bring lots of different ontologies together, there are going to be times when two subject proxies appear and they didn't get merged. And people will start arguing they should have been merged. Fine, that's what we want. Because eventually they will get merged if they're mergeable. All right? So, let's look inside of a subject proxy with that slide there, subject map subjects. This is a frame-based representation. You can use frames. You could use Prolog. You could write these in Java if you want. It doesn't make any difference how you actually implement it. You could do subject maps in Excel. There's no magic here, folks. The magic is in the subject identity properties and the merging rules. Nothing else. We're not bringing anything really new to the ontology table except an approach to best practices for subject identity, which some can argue is right now fairly weak in the semantic web arena. They're still using names for things as their identifiers, and I think there's evidence, strong evidence, that they're starting to find a way to move away from that, and I salute that. So a subject proxy has a locator. I called it a rose. I can use a semantic word for a locator. What is a locator? It's a unique identifier in this database. It identifies a row in the database. That's what it does. And you probably want a unique identity. You don't want multiple rows in a database. But some of the columns in the database would be all of the other names that that particular object could have. And those names need to be scoped, for example, to the language. So we know that the word rose scopes both to English, French, and Deutsch, but it doesn't to Russian. Help me out. Is that Rosa? Yeah. I don't. Can you read that? It's got the little funky backwards E. Okay, so that's. I copied that off the web. So in other words, in Russian, you don't get to use ROSE. That's. It's a trivial point, but the point is that names are not good enough to identify things. And so they don't count as subject identifiers. So that's enough. Next slide. Let's go into examples. Okay, so I have two contrived examples here. The first one is what happens, and you have to understand that if you worked for the National Security Agency or the NSF or the FBI or the CIA. I think 9/11 showed us what happens when authorities got involved, when lesser employees hauled off and said, I think X, Y, and Z is going on, and somebody said, it can't be. Okay. There is a clear case, and NSA really understands this, where you really do want to federate what all of the agents think. They don't have to be right or wrong. You just want to see what they think. And you'd like to know how they got to it. Subject maps are very clearly indicated. So I've invented, open up the imported analysis where I've invented a scenario where two different agents were shown a film of some scenario and one of them named it a Frob and another one named it a Framus. I made those names up, though. And one of them said, this is clearly a dangerous situation, and the other one said, it's clearly a benign situation. Okay, so those go into the topic map or the subject map, and they just sit there as is. So let's go to the next slide. And what happens in the merge process, through discussions, they find out that those different names were actually the same scene. Okay? Nobody knew that in the beginning. But they found out they were so, we have two different names for the same scene, and we have two different opinions. So what we do is we scope the opinions to the originator. Anytime you do a federation, you scope what you merged to its originating source. That's the beginnings of what I will call the wormhole theory. You're actually providing insights into other people's worldviews. Yes?
What happens if they're not identical but overlapping?
Very, very good question. An outstanding question. And it's one that I'll claim is suitable for open research. And it is the one which, when we do our Boolean subject maps, the ones where things just do merge or don't merge, we're going to have a lot of arguments. And I personally conjecture we're headed for something where there's going to be fuzzy numbers and relationships defined, where you will have two subjects and you will define an overlaps with relationship. And we don't really know how to do that yet. But it may have something to do with Bayes. It may have something to do with fuzzy. We don't know. But that's an outstanding question, and it's high on my list of things to think about. It should be yours too. So that's the nature of federation, is you bring the two together in under one subject proxy. This is two proxies merged into one, and their relationships to their work product is scoped. So we can go on. That's the first example. Let's go to the imported ontologies. These are the two ontologies I showed you at the beginning where we were kind of creating a context for this. So there they are again, psych and sumo. And what happens is you literally read the files in and you create subject proxies, and that's what you get. Earth calling. Was that my computer that did it? Isn't that special? Okay, well then I'll thump it every once in a while. How's that? There they are, and what we've done is we've imported them physically and we've created two subject proxies. And if we go to the next slide, we were able to merge them into one, and the reason we were able to merge them into the one was, remember those two red subject properties that I defined, and it was the has number of nucleuses. They only had one. So we were able to make a determination. Right or wrong, it's not an issue here at the moment because that starts public debate. But we were able to merge them into one proxy, and this allows us then to do a union of all of the properties each brought to the table. So I got more bang for the buck by doing the federation. Okay, so let's we can go on. What did you do? Take me off?
No. I'm trying to get screwed in some file.
Oh. So we can leave this. Those are my two trivial examples. And I said earlier, this is all fairly new work. It's doing subject identity properties is a tough project. And bandwidth that they give us at SRI to work on these projects has been squeezed dramatically because we're in that testing phase that Bill mentioned. And so that's what I get to do. Let's go look at the benefits. I've already told you what's coming, wormholes. So let's do the wormholes from merging. It's just a little graphic that shows you that if I ended up merging node D and node N, then what happens is, node C and node N, they end up together in one subject proxy, but they remain linked to the outer world. Let's go to the next slide, down. Let's go to this one, intersecting universes. You really are forming the intersection, and there's going to be many intersections. This would be a really wild diagram if you tried to draw it for a full Monty set of ontologies in the bioinformatics field. But one subject proxy is going to have links to n number of universes. And so we can go back to that wormhole diagram. I commissioned an artist in our group to do this links between universes. I was looking, this one doesn't do it. I was looking for something that's a little more exciting, but it's the idea. This is the universe of discourse of one tribe, and this is the universe of discourse of another tribe, and you can form these wormholes between them, and that's where the Federation buys you benefits for society across all kinds of dimensions. So next slide. Where are we? Dynamic knowledge repositories. Let's look at that one. Any subject proxy is going to be linked out to many universes of discourse, and those are going to be changing all the time. This is what Douglas Engelbart is trying to create for his communities of practices that he calls networked improvement communities, is a dynamic knowledge repository. And I've shown that a dynamic knowledge repository that is essentially a subject map that federates all of the communities of practice is probably the most useful approach. And I found on the web, this slide doesn't do it justice, but the idea is that a subject proxy becomes an attractor basin in the dynamical sense that lots of things will orbit around that subject. And those things are very dynamical in nature. So that's all I'm trying to show you on that slide. Let's go down. We can back out of this slide. So the technology. What is available today? There is a topic map tab for Protégé already. This I'm going to show. I'm using these same slides tomorrow, but I'm going to have a different spiel because it's going to be a lot different interest. There is TM tab that's available. You can download it. It turns out not to be open source, but it's based on the open source XTM for J platform. Cal Ahmed made that. So you can do XTM topic maps in Protégé today. Next, back out of that one. I've been doing a project called Topic Spaces, which is a subject map provider. It's also going to be open source. It's Java. And since I was talking at the Stanford, the Protégé conference, I went ahead and I made a tab for Protégé and plugged it in, and it came up. Now, don't get excited because it's not wired to Protégé. You can't actually do ontology engineering from it, but it will be. I mean, Vinay Chaudhry at SRI said that he has one of his guys that when we can find the bandwidth, he knows how to wire it. That's fine. I'd like that very much. So that's topic spaces. A little diagram of the architecture of topic spaces is fundamentally at core, it's a society of agents. There's a subject map provider that knows how to create and maintain subject proxies. And around that is a core ontology. And the core ontology is the ontological commitments I decided to make to build a framework, not to describe a universe, but to give you anchors to describe the universe however you want. And that's the point. You write applications on it, and there you hang your ontologies any way you want. Okay, so that's the nature of the beast. It's a subject map provider. It's a content management system, and it provides services. It uses Java portlets. Portlets are these little servlet ideas, except each little message is its own little window. And that means that you could have a stock market ticker, and you can have the weather, and you can have all these other things on your screen, throw them away and bring up something else. So this is a portlet engine. It includes an implementation of tuple space. This, you may have heard of David Glertner's Lynda, which is it's a coordination system for agentry that allows agents to throw into a space tuples. Database people know what tuples are, but they're just little sets of objects that have identifiers on them. So other agents can sit and watch for certain identities to come along and say, oh, that's mine, and then pull it out, do some work on it, put the result back. Somebody else is sitting there waiting for the result. So you can have agents all over the planet talking to this portal, doing things with the subject map. That's the theory behind it. And then it also has ordinary web services so that, like Google Maps and all of the rest, you can do what we call mashups. Do you like that word? I love it. Ted Nelson called it transclusion. The thesis behind it is there should only be one place on the planet where something is represented, because if the date changes or something else, that's the place you go to fix it. Otherwise, you have to go to all these other databases and say, did you know Joe's birth date was wrong? You know, that kind of thing. So he came up in 1960, the same year he invented the word hypertext, he came up with the idea of transclusion, which is, let's just share our information. Okay? It's a wonderful idea. Well, guess what? The semantic web figured it out. They call it mashups. I love it. And that's what Google is doing with their maps. You can take their maps and put the little dots on it all by yourself. So that's the shameless pitch for Topic Spaces. It's open source and it's Java and it's not ready for prime time yet. But let's look at one more object, and that's the Ontopia Knowledge Federation. These are the guys that do XTM and they do it well. They're in Norway, ontopia.net. And they have they've gone and federated the schools in Scandinavia, which is really kind of cool. And so they have this you can go to the Ontopia.net site and get to all these papers, one of which is about knowledge federation. And their idea is you have multiple knowledge portals, and the connections, the links between subjects, same subjects in that, gives you the very long distance wormholes. And it's really good work. It's not subject maps. They don't do what we do, but that's all right. They're doing a lot of really good work for a lot of very important things. So that's the current wrap-up of the technology, and I think I'm out of time.
Questions?
Yeah, questions. I was so good, there's no questions. This is awesome. Peter.
How did this relate back to
IRIS? I opened this talk with wrapping. Okay, Peter, can you bring up a web browser? Okay, then type in their IRIS. Just type in their, I'm sorry, tagomizer.sri.com. Okay, and type in guest user. User. No. One word, guest user. And now guest with an exclamation point. No. Ta-da! There's Tagomizer. Tagomizer is delicious sitting on top of Topic Spaces. But it's cool. I love it. At any rate, it's the same thing as delicious, except I wrote it. And theoretically, that makes it better. But here's something. I want to give you a little clue. You'll notice that there are, so if you scroll down, you'll see large blocks of, I'm very fond when I do bookmarking of putting, copying and pasting stuff in there so that you have something to read. So click on this thing called permalink. Notice what I've done. This is what I call, the theory behind this, I call it augmented storytelling. There are two worldviews that I carry. One is that all the world's a stage. Everybody's an actor, and there's all kinds of scripts and things going on all the time. And these are representable. You can capture them and you represent them. But one of the ways you capture them is in stories. That's what we do, is tell stories. I'm telling stories now. Okay, well, I claim that stories are sacred. So the place where you tell the story, this is where I think wikis get it wrong. Here I go on my soapbox. But wikis get it wrong because they let anybody edit anybody's stuff. And Wikipedia, I went into the early, in 2002, I went into the dev email list behind Wikipedia and read all of these horror stories about these jerks that would go on and trash pages. And they were having these endless debates over what to do with number 27. He just keeps coming back and back and back. And some of them said, no, we have to be democratic. We can't do that and this and that and the other thing. And I said, okay, when I make my wiki, nobody edits anybody else's stuff, period. And so that's what I did. So I created something right out of Douglas Engelbart called an addressable information resource. That is to say, you as an author can declare an individual word or a paragraph or a whole page an addressable information resource, and it has your name on it, and nobody else can edit it. But people want to argue about it, so I give AIRs their own homepage. That's a subject in its own right. What you said here is a subject. So it's a subject in the subject map. Now, what you don't see, because this is immature, there would be a place where I can put links. There would be a place where I can do dialogue mapping and argue about what was said here. Now, the original author or a superuser could come back and fix it. But nobody else. So that's the way topic spaces is architected, is around what I call augmented storytelling. And it says, what you say is sacred. And we're not going to mess it up. But we're going to give people a private place to go argue about it. Wikipedia does. They have an edit tab. You go off story and you talk about it. Unfortunately, somebody can log in and change what you wrote. They're starting to learn you don't do that. Did you have a question, Bill? Bill?
Yeah, so let's say, you know, someone says blue's made green cheese, and then someone else makes an ASR and says that's false.
No, they wouldn't do that. That'd be more like blogging it. No, they'd go right here and they'd say, question, what do you mean green cheese? And the guy would, and whatever. And then you'd say, well, I disagree.
Okay, but what if some, like you said, the either the superuser or the original author would go and change that original assertion?
Yeah, I'd probably go in and change it to blue. But the point is that but the commentary is associated with the version number.
Oh, with the original.
And you have version numbers, so you can always go down the version tree and see what people were saying. You want to leave it there so scholars can see the history of the ideas, okay? If you wrote down the, you can use it. Please don't try and do any editing or anything. These slides are online. My slides are online. No. They're the HTML you just saw. I don't use the word slides anymore. My presentation is online in a zip file of a bunch of HTML files.
Okay.
I could probably go in and make it linear in a PDF file, but that would ruin it. It says index.html. Start there. You're on your own. I'm sorry, yes. Listen, this is the good eye, this is the bad eye. I'll close this eye, I'm talking to you.
I didn't understand something. But you can deliver some discourses that people are using, and you have this proxy.
Yes.
For the object, and they point to the different universes of discourse, right?
They can, yes.
Okay. And then when you merge two such proxies, how do you know that? So, what does it guarantee that you speak about
the same action? Oh, hey. There's no guarantees in life. That's what your mother should have told you that already. Okay. But what we try to guarantee you is if you go to a good subject map or topic map, you'll need to go to one place to read about some subject. Okay. Now, in the merging process, if you declared this set of rules for identifying this object, and I read those rules and agreed with them and merged you into me, it's based on your authority. And I think we can agree that not always are authorities right. Okay, so I'm going to do the merge on your authority, and then I'm going to sit back and watch people argue about it. And that's where the action is, folks, because you're going to have to come in and defend what you said over here, or not. And if you don't defend it, the weight of the other arguments will say, and shove you out.
Okay, are these rules, these mapping rules, somehow formally represented, or are they just...
The TMRM requires that you disclose them.
But it's some logical language?
Could be. They haven't even gotten to the point where they have a recommended best practices. They're working really hard not to specify. You could write it in common logic. You could write them in KIF. You could write them in English prose. In my case, I implemented them. They're there for you to play with. Okay? And they're right there, and you can see how they work.
I have another question.
Yes?
Also related to this. So this means you showed a slide about merging sumo and psych.
Psych, yeah.
So how, again, I know there are no guarantees, but if you merge two terms, you get a bigger set of definitions or something.
Sure do.
Right, and how do you know that it doesn't contain any contradictions?
Oh, but this is wonderful. I don't care.
Okay.
That's the point. You see, if I appeal to authority, and okay, all right. I have two classes that say oxygen molecule, and we know that there's what is it, O16, is it? Atomic number is 16, but this guy said it's 17. But we merged them anyhow. So now we have conflicting opinions. That's what's going to happen. That's what's for lunch, okay? Now, that's a really stupid thing. We're not going to do that, okay? That's not going to happen. But I think you can imagine a scenario where somebody is going to have... Let's take religions. And we've taken all of the great religions, and they all reduce down to a set of primitives, and those get merged. There's going to be biblical scholars that are going to argue those points till hell freezes over, and it's going to be good for humanity to see those arguments. They're out on the surface now. They are not back in some little room back in where people are saying, "I believe this." You know, they're going to be out there for people to read, scholars to discuss, people on the street. So that's a far out, that's the other extreme, all right? But in between, day-to-day stuff, the day-to-day kinds of things, bioinformatics. Okay, let's say, this is my favorite example. You go to a doctor. Now, when you go to a doctor and you ask, you present some symptoms, and the doctor goes down the checklist and said, "You have X." And you say, "I hope you aren't mad at me, but I'm going to go talk to the other doctor for another opinion," and you do. Turns out, if you're in this town, all doctors seem to orbit around Stanford, so they all seem to have the same opinion. So you're really a good idea to leave town and go somewhere else to get a second opinion. Okay? And people do that. And you go to another doctor somewhere else, and he says, "Well, actually, it looks like X, but it's Y." Now you really are going to want to go on the web and get all possible opinions and all the arguments. Because it's your body and it's your life at stake. There's a really good set of reasons for, right or wrong, bringing all of these ideas together. Because the wrong ones will get plastered with arguments. And it's your choice, it's your body, it's your life, to look at those.
Do you also have the goal of publishing at some time the right thing somehow, or, you know, after you filtered out the wrong argument or the wrong statement or something, or that's
possible? First of all, I'm thinking in terms of what we call the social computing. I tend to think that the bloggers will take on these arguments, and they'll get federated. And that means that you get opinions way beyond just what was stated here. I don't think that the semantic web should be totally about authority. I mean, if you recall, Bill Joy went and took the Unabomber's Manifesto and reprinted it in Wired magazine under his name, with the title, "The Future Doesn't Need Us." And people read it and said, "Bill Joy is so cool," until they got to the last line where he said, "Oh, by the way, Ted Kaczynski wrote this." And everybody said, "Oh, you know, the point is that it's authorities are branded against people, not against content. And what we need is to look at the content in its depth, right or wrong." Kaczynski may have been right. We really don't like his way of expressing himself, but we certainly think that he said some cogent things. But you didn't get to read them that way when he first put them in the New York Times, because it was Ted Kaczynski. And Bill Joy made this very clear. So we need to be able to federate ideas and let the web resolve them. Let humanity resolve them. Now, that's a completely different use case than coming up with an ontology that quite literally deals with breast cancer or whatever. When you go to a doctor, you really want some authority. But you don't have to trust it. You want to see some other authority, which may have seen the world a different way. Federation to me is bringing those together, no matter how incorrect they might appear to some authorities. Okay? Does that answer your question? It's a limited use case, but I think it's an important one. Somebody had to make some ontological commitments to get the damn thing to run in the first place. And so I had to write a little upper ontology that is there for you to use, but not for you to represent your domain of discourse. It gives you a catalog of properties to use. And the more you use my properties instead of inventing your own, the more other applications that plug in will be able to talk. It's value neutral, yes. I can use, for example, dublincore.creator:creator, dc.creator, where somebody else will say, come up with, Joe:author. Why did he have to do that? Dublin Core already said creator will do the job. And the semantics of DC creator is the same as his Joe:author, okay? So I encourage you in topic spaces to use the core set that I've given you. But if you come in with, and if I'm importing OWL, I'll import what you created in your OWL ontology. It will come in exactly as you, but it will be represented in a slightly different way to hang inside of my framework. But that's all. You could write your ontology in core frames. You could, I should theoretically be able to just take an export from Protégé in its frame representation and bring it in and map it to subject proxies. I should be able to do that. I haven't done it yet, but it's possible. That answer your question? Other questions? Yep.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit more about ontological commitments in the topic map reference model? What I'm curious about is
well, the TMRM, as it exists as a recommendation to become a standard part of ISO 13250, makes only one ontological commitment, and that is you shall declare what ontological commitments you make, and you shall declare what merging rules, which axioms, apply. And they're most interested in subject identities. They're less interested in any of the other stuff of your universe of discourse. They really are anal about identifying subjects. Nothing else. After that, you can write your subject map any way you want. Now, that sounds like it's really loosey-goosey. It turns out to be not that loosey-goosey. You really do have to think through your subject identity properties, and that's where some documents on best practices would be of value. We don't have them yet. We're all working towards that. So the ontological commitments that I made in topic spaces are just my best guess at the tool set needed to suck up OWL, to suck up Protégé, whatever, the low-hanging fruits, and bring them into the subject map area so that we can federate them. That's I'm not sure I answered your question.
I think it helps. What I'm taking away from it is what the phrase ontological commitment is used in the context of topic map reference model. It focuses primarily on subject identification.
Right.
Not on the other semantic properties that may or may not be.
No, if you choose hair color, my suggestion, my idea of best practices is to go with what the web is already doing. OWL is setting a lot of valuable standards, FOF, Dublin Core, etc. They're all becoming well used. To ignore them in subject map land is to turn your back on some really good thinking. So that's the approach I'm taking in topic spaces is to make a framework that starts with a tool set that others are using. That way it doesn't force people to change their culture just to talk to it. Other questions? Oh, goody.
Is that a question or is that an exercise? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So best practices.
The good concept to start to define and describe and give examples to
try to illustrate. We have a gap, you might say. We just got back a little while ago from lunch. We're supposed to have a break at 3:30.